You are listening to the Dan Patrick Show on Fox Sports Radio.
The pride of Bowling Green is Scotty Miller, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers wide receiver, joins us on the program. Scotty, thanks for joining us. Congratulations getting to the Super Bowl.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
All right, take me into the huddle. Final play, first half. What's the play call?
Yeah, so, I mean, even before that, just to go for it, that was a big decision for the coaches on that fourth down. But then for that play call, we just called a go route for me and Mike. I really thought it was going to turn into a Hail Mary type of thing. I was telling Chris before the play to widen out with me in the bunch. But then that came out in just single high defense, so I was able to get a one-on-one matchup. And he wasn't even bailing too fast, like I'm sure you've seen. So I was able to just get right by him.
But when did you know that this could turn into a touchdown?
Yeah, so like before the play, like I said, I wasn't really expecting this to happen at all. But right when I took off and I saw him not running, in my head I'm like, dude, I'm like, number 20, you better start running. And I said, I'm gonna go right by you. So at that moment when I saw him just kind of like in a slow backpedal, I'm like, I'm about to score. And then I looked up and saw Tom, saw the same thing I did. The ball was just floating. So,
but how do you hide or disguise that you're going to go deep like that? I think that they thought you guys were going to try to get into field goal range, but how do you hide the fact that, hey, I'm going to try to blow right by you?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I think, first of all, the coaches did a good job. I was in a cut split in a bunch, so they probably thought I was going to go run an out route or something like that. But for me, like as far as my technique, just run right at his blind spot where he can't see me because his eyes are looking at the quarterback. So he doesn't know if I'm going to break out. You know, it kind of confuses him when I run right at his blind spot. And then I just, at that point, stick my foot in the ground and go by him.
What did Brady say after the touchdown?
Honestly, I don't even know if I remember. I was going crazy. I was like running circles in the end zone. I don't even know what was going on. But it was an unbelievable moment. He was pumped. He came. He's always celebrating with us in the end zone. That he's big on that. So, you know, something like, let's go, you know, so it's cool.
Did you keep the football?
Yeah, I got it. Absolutely.
I think get Brady to autograph it.
Yeah, that'd be nice. Yeah, I gotta get a couple signatures from him after the season. Get a jersey, football.
I don't think you could get King to sign it, though, the Packers defensive back. I think that would be mean-spirited, though, Scotty. When did you know you were fast?
Ever since I was able to run, really. From a young age, I've always been the fastest one in my grade. And I remember winning races, field day in fifth grade, stuff like that. I've always been just naturally God-given, just blessed with blessed and fortunate with speed.
But it's one thing to run on recess in a playground. Then you get on a football field, and when did there's quickness and then there's speed. When did you realize you had speed?
Same type of thing. For me, it's always, I've been doing the same type of thing ever since I was a little kid. If you look at highlights from when I was playing youth football in fifth grade when I started, I was doing the same thing, just running by dudes and catching deep balls. So I've really had it my whole life. But then I did, like, in high school, I think I really, once I started running track, I really started to develop and know that I could run with the best of them.
But you run a 4.39 at your pro day. Is that the best you've ever run?
Yeah, I mean, that I would like to say it was a little lower than that. I wish I got invited to the combine so I had, like, a laser timing, because at my pro day, I had, like, 20 scouts with hand times. And some dudes told me I ran the high 4.2s. Some guys told me mid 4.3s. It was just, like, everywhere. And then 4.39 came out. I don't know where that exactly comes from, but I wish I ran one where I could tell people exactly what I ran.
But you get labeled. Like you probably got bunched in with Julian Edelman and Wes Welker, even though you're not really like them and you play in the MAC, you weren't highly recruited. Like, how did you fall through the cracks where you really had a hard time just, you know, getting somebody's eyes on you?
Yeah, it's always been it's a tough road for me ever since high school, just getting noticed. Only have one FBS offer, and I think it's just because I'm undersized. I'm still undersized in the NFL, but that's always made me work even harder to prove people wrong, and I love the doubters.
Any defensive backs say, man, you're a little bit faster than I thought?
Yeah, I mean, that's whenever I get to a team, whether it be Bowling Green or now with the Bucks or anybody I play against, everyone always just tell me that.
But you and Brady got something in common, though. Sixth-round draft picks, like, you know.
That's right. Hopefully, I can have a similar career to him.
Official height and weight, not program, official height and weight.
I'm 5'9" right now. Probably lost a couple pounds in the season. Probably 170.
You sure you're 5'9"?
Yes, I'm 5'9". Yes.
Okay. I mean, it sounds better if you're 5'8", like 5'8 and a half. Like, how would you do if you and Tyreek Hill lined up?
Oh, I'm taking me every day of the week. I'll take me over anybody. Tyreek is unbelievable, super quick, unbelievable talent. But if we're talking about race, I mean, I got all the confidence in myself against going up against anybody.
Wait, you think you're the fastest guy in the NFL?
Yes, sir.
What's that like, though, to get in the blocks in high school and you're running 100 meters and you look around, they're probably looking at you like, this guy run? Like, did you have that feeling?
Absolutely, yeah. I think people always slept on me, but they're going to find out really quick. Once that gun goes off, they're going to find out really quick who's the fastest one.
What's the nickname that you have?
Scooter is the big one, especially this year. Tom really drove that one home. So that's what everyone's been calling me.
We got to get something a little more badass. Like Scoot is, I don't know. How about Smoke?
Smoke, yeah, I like
smoke,
it.
I like smoke, smoke. But you know, I was thinking maybe you don't want a name that's flashy where you draw too much attention. Like
you got to fly under the radar. Yeah, it's not a bad thing.
Yeah, he's Scotty Miller. He's the Tampa Bay Buccaneers wide receiver. That flight back home, what was it like from Green Bay?
Oh, it was amazing. It was so much fun. The locker room after was insane. I never experienced anything like that. Of course, you got Gronk going crazy the whole time. And just everybody having so much fun.
Did Gronk have his shirt off?
Oh, yeah. You already know. You already know he did. Dancing all over the place. Everyone's taking videos of him. But we got such a great group of guys. We had a great time.
But this is pretty amazing. You're what, 23?
Yes, sir.
And you're around Tom Brady. I mean,
yeah, it's wild. I could never imagine any of this stuff happening. So I'm just taking it one day at a time. It's a crazy experience.
Has he yelled at you before?
Yeah. He hasn't got after me too bad. But I mean, he gets on everybody. He expects greatness. So he's going to get it out of you.
What's it like with, are you guys going to be in your home or in a hotel, Super Bowl week?
We are going to be at home. I think we only show up to the hotel the night before the game, so I'll be at home these next 2 weeks.
Are you okay with that?
Yeah, absolutely. I like it. It's where I'm comfortable. I got my wife here, so just get to hang out with her just like I normally do and try to make the moment not as big as it is, and I think that'll help out.
You watch film already with the Chiefs?
Yeah, and we've played them. As you know, we played them earlier, so I know a lot what they do. I know the guys that they have. But we'll really get after that tomorrow. We'll be in the building all day and then pretty much every day leading up to the Super Bowl.
Are you recognized in Tampa?
This year's different because I don't even go out. And in that last round, I think anyone would know who I am. This year, probably still not. But occasionally, if I'm at the mall or something, sometimes people will, you know, say something to me. But if you look at me, you probably don't think that's an NFL player, so.
Even if you had your jersey on, though, Scotty.
They may think I'm just some fan wearing the number 10, and they're wondering who number 10 is. But
how many tickets do you get for the Super Bowl?
I still don't know the answer to that question. They're trying to figure it out. I've heard a whole bunch of different things, but I'm hoping to get as many as I can.
But what kind of requests? How many people have asked for tickets?
Oh my goodness. I mean, everybody you could think of, who doesn't want to come to the Super Bowl. So that's where it's tough, to figure out who, but I hope I get at least three so I can at least get my parents and my wife to come and then, you know, try and get, a couple other people that are really meaningful to me in my life.
But will you tell your kids about Gronk or about Brady?
Gronk would probably be the first one to come to mind because all the stories and all the.
Well,
crazy.
Give me a story. Like, what's the one where you come home and you say to your wife, "This is Gronk."
Man, I don't know if I can point to one off the top of my head, but I mean, we were playing basketball and just watching him play basketball is pretty funny. It was at Berkeley in the summer. Just watching him go up and dunk and kind of joke around. And just the way he goes about it, he's just hilarious.
But he's not going to be doing keg stands or anything like that. You missed out on that Gronk.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, we win the next one. I don't know. Maybe coming out of retirement. I don't know. Let's see.
Hey, well, congratulations. It's been a fun ride, and big time stuff though going out on that field. But you get to play. Are you going to feel like it's a home game?
I don't know, honestly. I mean, we'll see. I think it's going to definitely make it seem a lot like not as big of a moment because we're playing our home stadium where we always play on any given Sunday. But we'll see. I think we're all really excited to have a lot of our fans are going to be there. So it's going to be fun.
Yeah, it'll be different from Lambeau. But look, you played in Bowling Green. So that, you know, I mean, you played in cold weather. You're from Chicago. So that's nothing. Now you get to, you know, playing Tampa.
Hey, this year I've been used to, not everyone's used to playing in cold weather with no fans there. That's one thing I've been used to my whole life, really.
That was your college career, right?
Exactly, yeah.
Hey, congrats, though, Scotty, and it'll be fun watching you, and good luck.
Thanks, man. I appreciate you.
That's Scotty Miller. Smoke Miller. Thanks for listening to the Dan Patrick Show podcast. Be sure to catch us live every weekday morning, 9 to noon Eastern, or 6 to 9 Pacific on Fox Sports Radio. Find your local station for the Dan Patrick Show at foxsportsradio.com or stream us live every day on the iHeartRadio app by searching FSR. Or stream us live on the Peacock app. Let's bring in a friend of the show, Carson Palmer, the former number one overall pick by the Bengals, Heisman Trophy winner at USC. And he is now a College Football Hall of Famer. Carson, how are you today?
I'm well, Dan. Thanks for having me on.
Where do you want to start?
Wherever you want to go.
How would you feel if you're Jared Goff?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough situation. He's gone in and he started, you know, his career really slowly, obviously with the end of the Coach Fisher era. And then with Coach McVay coming in, he was hot and they were on fire and Todd Gurley was rolling. But as soon as you saw Gurley slow down with the injuries, you started to notice that he was the centerpiece of that offense. He was the engine that made that offense go. Without Gurley and without some of the weapons they've been missing, guys like Cooper Kupp with injuries, Goff has looked like he doesn't have the ability to carry a team on his shoulders. And it sounds like the Rams have figured that out and maybe looking to go in a different direction.
But also, you look at these quarterbacks now, Carson, compare how you were coming out of USC and being ready for the NFL with, let's say, I know your brother's been working out, Trevor Lawrence. How ready Trevor Lawrence is compared to the way you were when you were coming out of USC?
Oh, Trevor Lawrence is just as prepared as anybody that's coming onto from the college scene into the NFL scene. I mean, he's been in a very very difficult pro style offense. He's played against great competition in a future NFL players. He's no doubt ready. I mean, he's still got another year left. He still has he could go back and continue to develop, but. You know, he's ready. He's physically ready. He's mentally ready. He's played on big stages and played extremely well on big stages. So, you know, he's as ready as myself, you know, Andrew Luck, you name it. He's prepared, going to Clemson, playing for that coaching staff. There's no doubt in my mind he's ready to translate in the NFL.
What's your brother say about Trevor Lawrence? What's the biggest, best thing that he does?
I think the thing that jumped out to me is just maturity. He just said, that, you know, for a guy that's still got time left at the college level and, you know, he came in and played as a true freshman. The first thing that he said, and it's the same thing he said about Joe Burrow last year, was maturity. And, I want to hear about arm talent and speed and quickness and release and how's his whip and, you know, accuracy, all those things. And the two things that jumped out at me when he started talking about Joe Burrow and Trevor was they're just mature beyond their years.
And that's interesting, but that's really important because I go back to what Urban Meyer said about Dwayne Haskins prior to the draft. He said maturity concerns here. And I don't know if we ever factor that in or how tangible something like that is. We're always looking for how quick are you? What's your Wunderlich test score? How do you do in front of the whiteboard? What are your medicals there? But to understand maturity, like how do you gauge that?
Well, it should have been a red flag for the Redskins when the head coach of the university that player was coming from says that. I mean, that to me, you know, you hear so many coaches hype up players, and that's their job. Their job is to recruit these high school kids at 18 and tell their mom and dad they're going to take care of them, be a father figure for them on campus, you know, develop those players mentally and physically, and then start singing their praises when they're getting ready to go to the NFL, because that is good on those head coaches' resumes when they have high draft picks or number one, number two, number three picks. But when the head coach that's supposed to be singing your praises isn't, to me, that's a massive red flag.
Bruce Arians was your head coach with the Cardinals. What kind of coach was he?
Old school. With so many of these young head coaches you're seeing, and Matt LaFleur and Sean McVay and so on and so forth, Bruce didn't play that game. Bruce was a grinder, and he still is a grinder. You're going to practice every opportunity that the CBA lets you practice. We're going to be on the field. We're going to have pads on. We're going to be thumping. And there's so many other, these young coaches come in, they want to do walkthroughs and they want to sit in more meetings and they want to talk more football. Bruce is old school. Bruce will talk a little bit of football, but he wants to be out on the field proving it. And that's what's so amazing to me about Tom Brady is not missing practices. He's not taking veteran days off. He's not rehabbing small injuries. He's practicing week in, week out. And just knowing the way that Bruce rolls, that's one of the things that got the Tampa Bay Buccaneers in the Super Bowl game, is that work ethic that Bruce has brought in and instilled in that program.
But how important do you think his personality, his approach, being different from Bill Belichick's, maybe suited Tom Brady, or Brady, it attracted Brady to the Buccaneers?
Well, I think the first thing that attracted Brady to the Buccaneers is the talent level. Everybody was so shocked that, why would Brady go to Tampa? I can't believe he's not going to L.A. or New York. He wouldn't worry about market size. Brady was worried about playmakers. You know, his last couple of years in New England, Julian Edelman was his number one. You know, Julian Edelman would have 7 catches for 65 yards. He needed a guy like Mike Evans that could have 5 catches for 170, and Godwin who could have 8 catches for 178. You know, he needed that explosiveness, and he knew it. So he didn't care about the market size or the coaching staff. He was really going to a place that had great players. I mean, you look at that roster offensively, defensively, on the offensive line and defensive line. I mean, that team is extremely well built by Jason Light, the GM there. And that's what he was looking for. You've heard, you know, Bruce talk about Brady's coaching ability, and he's always talking to younger players and, you know, in their ears and giving them pointers here and there. He knew he could help on the coaching side. He needed athletes. He needed talent. And he found the most talented roster, and that's why he's in Tampa.
What does Brady do better than Patrick Mahomes?
It's obviously not physical. It's all upstairs. I think his understanding of defenses, his understanding of his own protection schemes and how to change those protection schemes in split seconds at the line of scrimmage. I mean, Patrick's a smart kid and obviously a once in a generation talent physically, but Brady's got so many years of being in the moment, third and long, in the red zone, got to score situations where he had to change a protection or had to change a play within the matter of 3 seconds and get everybody on the same page with him on offense and execute the play. That takes years. That takes just time and time again, repetition over and over and over again. And Patrick doesn't quite have that underneath his belt like Tom does after 20 plus years in the league.
We just had Scotty Miller on last hour, and he said that he knew it was going to be a touchdown because he took 3 steps and he could see the defensive back was looking in the backfield at Brady. And he said, number 20, you better turn and run, because he was going to blow right by him. How often does that happen where you kind of see a touchdown before it's a touchdown?
Yeah, I'd say 2 or 3 times a game. I mean, you go into a game plan, you have 8 to 10 shots they're called shots, long play action, throwing the ball downfield 50, 60 plus yards. And every once in a while, a play comes in and you're calling it in the huddle and you're going, please, God, please be in quarters coverage, or please be in man, or please be in this zone. And every once in a while, you walk up the line of scrimmage, you see the bluff of the defense. They're trying to show single high. And then right as you're getting ready to snap, you see the defense unfold into the defense that they're going to play on that play. And you go, I got him. And that's exactly what happened on that play. I'm sure, as Scotty said, I'm sure the same thing was going on Brady's head, as they were bluffing cover 2 and they went to single high. He was just thinking, please number 20, please just stay low and let Scotty get on top of you. And I got a touchdown before the half.
He's Carson Palmer, the former Bengals quarterback and now a college football Hall of Famer. He's joining us on behalf of the CBD brand Levels Select. They're launching their new Level C immune support CBD oil drops to help people stay at the top of their game this cold and flu season. Why do you think the Players Association, or the NFL, I should say, relaxed the marijuana testing?
I just thought it was another issue they had to deal with. And, you know, it was just easier to relax it than be more stringent, especially with every, you know, it seems like every state in this country is legalizing it. It seemed that it just seemed, you know, to them as another hurdle, another issue, another media topic that they have to deal with. And with the rest of the country being more lax, they decided to lax their rules.
The difference between CBD and marijuana, if you could have smoked marijuana legally back when you were playing to get through, you know, aches and pains or whatever, would you?
If it helped me like CBD does, you know, I after playing for 15 years, I don't know, three knee surgeries on my left knee, thumb surgery, shoulder, all kinds of issues. You know, I'm at a point in my life now being 41 years old where I don't want to be in pain. And you get tired of being in pain. You get tired of that constant headache that you have in your knee. And so I use Level Select CBD on my knee. I'm going skiing today. It's dumping snow outside up in Idaho. So I want to feel as good as I possibly can trying to keep up with my kids on the ski slope. So, you know, it's something I use on a daily basis. It's something that, you know, I send to my folks. My parents use. They're in their 70s. It's something that's really helped me keep up with my kids and enjoy life the way I want to in football retirement.
What did you make Aaron Rodgers' comments after the loss to Tampa Bay on Sunday?
You know, Aaron's dramatic. And you know, as much as he doesn't want to be dramatic, I think sometimes he can't help it. You know, losing in the NFC Championship game, I've been there, I've done that. It's so hard to swallow quickly. It's something that takes time to let those heels, you know, those wounds heal. And you got to realize, I mean, that you go and interview a guy after he got done playing a season that he started training for the previous February, almost a year in advance, and was so focused on this is the year, this is it. They win their division. They have a home. They have the home championship game in their backyard. This is their year. And then, boom, it's over. And everybody goes their separate ways. And the team is completely different the next year. And you know it. Everybody in the locker room knows it. Some coaches are going to get fired maybe. Players' contracts aren't going to get renewed. And it's an easy moment to be dramatic. And as we all know, we've heard Aaron over the years, he gets very dramatic in some times, in some instances. And I just think – it was the culmination of a season ending. It didn't end the way he wanted. Every quarterback wants to go for it and not kick a field goal in that instance. And it's just, you know, it builds up inside you. And sometimes you just can't say the right PR thing. Sometimes you can't just put it to bed and say, hey, you know, we didn't win the game. I got to play better. You know, that's the way you want to, you know, you want to portray the end of a season. Unfortunately, he didn't portray it that way, and now he's got to deal with it for the next probably year until the next season starts.
Yeah, but you draft Jordan Love, and it's almost like it hit Rodgers on Sunday. You know, we drafted Jordan Love. We didn't draft a tight end. We didn't draft a wide receiver. We didn't draft a shutdown corner. We drafted my successor. And it's almost like he went, yeah, I don't know what's going to happen here. I mean, maybe I'm reading into it way too much, but it's almost like it hit Packer fans as well. Boy, it'd have been nice if we used that draft pick on a tight end, a wide receiver, a shutdown corner there. Maybe that factored in. I don't know.
Yeah, that's Aaron's sentiment. That's the, you know, the hidden agenda behind what he said. Aaron's not going anywhere. The Packers aren't trading Aaron. Aaron's the best player in the league, maybe the top two or three players in the league. He will be a Packer next year. He's pissed they used a first-round pick on a guy that was holding a clipboard behind him. He needed somebody in the huddle with him. So I understand his frustration. You know, I wish he would have phrased some of his comments post-game a little bit differently. But there's a lot of built-up in that. Like I said, I mean, that's an entire year's work that just ends instantly. And maybe that was kind of chipping away at him in the back of his head that, you know, their first round pick is standing next to him as he's watching the defense, you know, and then he jots out on the field and he needs weapons. He needs more than just, you know, Devontae. He needs more guys. And I'm sure that is something that's been chipping away at him. And so I think that's why that kind of came out that way. And like I said, now Aaron's got to continuously answer questions all off season and into next training camp about it.
The product is CBD. The brand is Level Select, and it's Level C immune support CBD oil drops to help people stay at the top of their game and can help somebody as old and decrepit as Carson go out on the ski slopes there in Idaho. Are you any good as a skier?
Not comparatively speaking here, but I'm still faster than my kids, and that's all that matters right now.
Can you still out-throw them? Can you throw the ball farther than them?
Yeah, but I mean, my oldest boy is 12, so I think I've got another calendar year. He can chuck it about 40 or 50 right now, and as he's going up, I'm slowly going down. So I got to take advantage of it while I got it.
Is he a quarterback?
He is. He is. He wants to play quarterback. He's my brother's got an online coaching academy called QB Summit that he's on every night. He's doing drills. We've got, you know, 7 feet of snow in our yard here, so he's in the garage doing footwork drills. I'm throwing bags at him. He's working, you know, stepping up in the pocket, avoiding bags. So yeah, we're training, and you know, I think he's got a pretty bright future. We'll see.
Has USC offered him a scholarship?
Not yet. Next year.
You think so?
His film here in Idaho is going to be pretty good because the competition level isn't quite that of Southern California.
Yeah.
So he's going to have good film. We'll see.
Great to talk to you, bud. And glad you're well. Thank you. That's Carson Palmer joining us on the program.
Be sure to catch the live edition of the Dan Patrick Show weekdays at 9 a.m. Eastern, 6 a.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app.
It's a tradition unlike any other. It feels like every year at this time, after the voting for the Baseball Hall of Fame, we have Bob Costas on to somehow come up with answers for Major League Baseball and the baseball writers of America. Bob, good morning. How are you?
Hello, Dan. How you doing?
It feels like this is a tradition where I go, let's get Bob on and he can explain what happened or what didn't happen. You're a voice of reason here. What happened yesterday?
Well, what happened is that Curt Schilling appears to have talked and tweeted his way out of the Hall of Fame. No matter how out of bounds a lot of his proclamations have been, and understand, Joel Sherman of the New York Post, one of the best baseball reporters, said this yesterday on the MLB N Network. Remember, he got more than 70% of the vote, and a very, very large percentage of the players, past and present, in the Baseball Hall of Fame are relatively conservative politically. This isn't a matter of Republican, Democrat, conservative, liberal. And I say this as somebody who through the years has had a good relationship with Curt Schilling, going all the way back to when he was with the Phillies. But a lot of what he has said and tweeted over the last few years is just completely out of bounds, including supporting the insurrection at the Capitol and things he has said about writers as a group, not specific individuals. So without that, he'd be over the line. Now, we might have expected Clemens and Bonds, who made a bit of a move up to 60% or so a year ago, to inch at least a little bit closer, and they barely moved at all. Part of the reason could be, and I'm just guessing here, Dan, it's this. Assuming they're able to have a ceremony, fingers crossed, this July in Cooperstown, some voters may have said, look, these three, these specific three, call them the Rogues Gallery of the Hall of Fame, Schilling, Clemens, Bonds, they could be a class of their own next year. But why should there be any discordant notes surrounding Derek Jeter, especially universally popular, yeah, plus Ted Simmons and Larry Walker and whoever represents Marvin Miller? Next year, the two, by statistics, certain Hall of Famers who come on the ballot for the first time are A-Rod and Big Papi. Now, I think David Ortiz will get a higher percentage of the vote, but whatever whiff of steroids is attached to Big Papi, who's very popular and was a great, great hitter, that may keep him out as a first ballot guy. And it's going to take A-Rod a while, if ever. And the Scott Rolands of the world, who are up around 50%, Todd Helton's, who've made a move, Sheffield moved up, none of those people loom for next year. Omar Vizquel was on his way up until the allegations of domestic abuse halted him, but he was only in his third or fourth year, so there's time for him to be rehabilitated, so to speak. So as you look at it, it's possible that if someone's going to vote for Schilling, Bonds, or Clemens, someone who's been a holdout, perhaps their initial reasons were just let them twist in the wind. My semi-protest will be, says this voter, this imaginary voter, my semi-protest will be that I make them wait until the last minute. I'll vote for them in year 10. Well, it turns out that year 10 sets up that it could very well be those three people on the stage, Clemens, Bonds, Schilling, if enough voters come around to say, okay, the coast is clear. In this situation, I can see it. It doesn't rain on anybody else's parade. I can see it next year. I'm not saying that will happen, but I wouldn't be at all surprised if the three of them move up closer to 75%, if not over it, in their.
How do you think the baseball writers would have reacted or would react if Schilling was already in the Hall of Fame and he had these tweets, he had these comments, he had this stance?
Well, there'd be all kinds of articles written about it, condemning it, but I doubt that he'd be removed. The baseball writers might be able to make a statement, but it would be up to the board of directors of the Hall of Fame to remove him or anybody else. And then you'd have to begin thinking about, boy, if we pull on that thread, does the entire garment unwind? These aren't the only sorts of offenses that people might find objectionable. Are we going to go back over the personal history to the extent that we know it of everybody who's in the Hall of Fame? And by the way, although it's apples and oranges a little bit, O.J. Simpson's bust is still in Canton.
Yeah, I just wonder, like, Schilling has no crimes against baseball. And
that's right. That's true.
So just trying to sort this out, Bonds has crimes against baseball, A-Rod does, Pete Rose does. Like, I'm just trying to sort this out and wonder what goes into the process here, Bob, because I may not like what Kurt tweets, but I could look at him as a baseball Hall of Famer. I didn't question his character, charitable contributions when he played, And I don't know if it's just, can I separate and just look at that? Is that, or am I being totally naive here?
No, I don't think you're being naive. I've said this for years. Now, he kind of stepped up some of his tweets in the past year to his detriment when it comes to the Hall of Fame, but he was out there for the last few years, and I always said that if I was a voter, and as you know, it's only baseball writers who have a vote, I always would have voted for Kurt Schilling. I would have voted for him on the first ballot, the best strikeout-to-walk ratio of any pitcher since 1900, remarkable postseason record. In addition to 11-2, he pitched in five elimination games in October. His record was 4-0, and the other one in which he had a no decision, his team also won the game, and his ERA in those five games was 1.37. Plus, it's a Hall of Fame. It's not just statistics. He's part of baseball lore, the Bloody Sock game, the Red Sox-Yankee rivalry, all that stuff. So I think he's a Hall of Famer, and I would like to see him elected, but someone's going to have to put an arm around his shoulder if he is elected and say, look, Kurt, this acceptance speech has to be 100% about baseball and baseball only. Yeah. We don't care if you talk about the Bloody Sock for 15 minutes, but we don't want you talking about Donald Trump for 15 seconds.
The Bonds and Clemens dilemma that comes up every year here. Do you think that their fate will be better resting in the hands of the Veterans Committee?
Not necessarily. Depends upon the composition of the particular committee. It's not all the same. They break it up into eras. And depending upon the composition of a 16-person panel, some of those people may feel particularly negatively toward it. Joe Morgan, for example, the late, great Joe Morgan, who was on the board's directors, the Hall of Fame's board of directors, he was always adamant about no steroid guys in the Hall of Fame. I don't know that that's universal, but there's certainly a strain of thinking in that way. So I don't think the Veterans Committee necessarily gives Bonds and Clemens a better shot at it.
Yeah, I'm just trying to, and I don't know if Schilling will be better suited for the Veterans Committee. Like, I think he thinks so. Would you say Schilling has a better chance with the Veterans Committee than Bonds and Clemens do?
I think so.
Yeah.
It's Schilling's feeling that he was respected by those he played with and against. And that's certainly true with very, very few exceptions. You know, he specifically took out after writers. I may not have the exact phrasing correct, but there was a cartoon that he put out on Facebook a couple of years ago, whatever it was, and it was journalist, rope, tree, some assembly required.
Yeah.
Even if he says that was tongue-in-cheek, come on. So I think some people may have taken that personally, which would be understandable.
A-Rod testing positive twice, so there's no rumor innuendo here. Like, he's had a great 5 years since he retired, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's like a body switch with him and Jeter that all of a sudden A-Rod's doing Shark Tank and Sunday Night Baseball. He's at the inauguration. Does any of this matter when it comes to voting next year? Or are these writers going to go, yeah, it's nice, but, you know, let's go back and look at all the things that he did and how he harmed baseball?
Well, a couple of things there, Dan. There are some writers who make a distinction, and it's a valid one, between players who may have used before baseball codified testing and specific penalties, and those who went ahead and did it even after that all had been codified. And A-Rod is certainly in that category. And then on top of that, he sued baseball and he had to sit out a year. So he's got all those demerits. But at the same time, look what's happened. A few years ago at the World Series, I was in the production trailer with a bunch of knowledgeable baseball guys. And I just happened to say, you know, a few years from now, A-Rod's Q rating is going to be higher than Derek Jeter's. And they looked at me as if I had three heads. But it turns out now to be correct, not because Jeter's is negative necessarily or has any more negatives next to it, but because A-Rod in public perception, you know, being about to marry J-Lo, I don't know if they got married or not yet, but they're engaged, whatever, being with J-Lo and being on TV, and he's a handsome guy. When he walks out on Jimmy Fallon or whatever, the place goes nuts. Yeah. So in terms of public perception, he's been largely rehabilitated. The writers are a little bit more aware than that, but many of them may say to themselves, wait a second, where are the guidelines here? Ken Rosenthal, very respected writer for The Athletic, has been saying that recently. I don't know how to parse all these things. Pete Rose on the outside looking in, A-Rod, not only a celebrity, but he's a baseball figure. He's on ESPN. You know, what's the objective standard here? What's the consistent standard here? And what are the voters supposed to make of it? Maybe the fact that A-Rod has been brought back into baseball, not just that his public persona is better than it once was, but that he's part of baseball. Maybe he doesn't work for the commissioner's office, but baseball accepts him as a fixture on Sunday Night Baseball and at other baseball events. Maybe that makes it easier for some people to say, look, I give up. I'm just doing it on what the numbers tell me.
And you also have this argument, which I don't buy into, but you'll hear, hey, this guy was a Hall of Famer before he started using. It doesn't work that way. Your career is your career. If you used, then you're not a Hall of Famer, in my opinion. It's not like, man, that guy was Father of the Year, well, until he had his mistress, but he was Father of the Year for, like, it doesn't work that way.
Well, but for a lot of people, it does. It's obvious that a lot of the voters make a distinction between, let's say, Bonds and Clemens, who clearly would have been first ballot Hall of Famers, inner circle Hall of Famers, if they had retired in the late 1990s, which is generally when we think, especially with Bonds, is pretty good evidence that that's where it began. Otherwise, Sammy Sosa would be up around 60% instead of at 17%. He hit over 600 homers. He hit better than 60 homers three times, and he's part of baseball history in the late 90s and early 2000s. So a huge percentage of the electorate does make the very distinction that you're saying doesn't matter.
Yeah, I know. I'm in the minority here. But, you know, it just comes down to it's a museum. It's for the fans. And, if the fans want people and they want to see it in their museum, then great. I got to the point where I don't enjoy baseball because it feels like there's always things on the periphery and never the game. We don't celebrate the game. And that's the really disheartening thing with all of this. We're not even celebrating the Hall of Fame or possibility of guys moving up. It's all about the guys who don't get in. And that's unfortunate. It really is.
Yeah. Well, after next year, that kind of moves into the shadows once again. No pun intended. Wasn't the book called Game of Shadows? And I didn't mean it that way. After the final year of eligibility, that takes care of it. But you want to talk about celebrating the game. Let's say, for the sake of argument, it's possible, if not likely, that all three of those guys get in. And that's the trio on the stage. No one else is elected. You know, Simmons and Walker and Jeter have had their day this summer, and those are the three.
Sure. Why not? Yeah.
You know, it's a good storyline,
yeah,
isn't it?
Why not? You know, cheer me up and tell me a great Hank Aaron story before I say goodbye.
Well, you may know this one already, but I just find it especially inspiring. He loved his dad. He wasn't complaining about his dad. It was just the reality of the day. When he told his father when he was a little kid, "I want to grow up to be a pilot," his dad said, "Ain't no colored pilots." And colored was the term used not only by many white Americans, but most black Americans then. "Ain't no colored pilots." When he later said, "I want to play in the major leagues," he said, "Ain't no colored ball players." In the late 1940s, when Hank was 14, 15 years old, the Dodgers come barnstorming up from Florida after spring training, as teams used to do, on their way back to Brooklyn. And they stop in Mobile to play an exhibition game. And Jackie Robinson addressed a small group of black citizens at a storefront. It was either a drugstore or a grocery store on the morning of the game. And young Hank Aaron skipped school to go to see him speak. He already had an idea that this was a guy who would inspire him. This was someone he looked up to. And then later, when the game was played that afternoon, Hank didn't have the money for a ticket. In fact, when he left home to first play professional baseball, he had $2 in his pocket. That's how impoverished the family was. So he didn't have money for a ticket, and he climbed a tree out beyond the right field fence of the ballpark in Mobile, and from there, he got his first glimpse of Jackie Robinson as a ball player. And from there, you think about it, he goes on to become, in many ways, because of his greatness as a player and because of his social significance, he is the most significant baseball player since Jackie Robinson. His idol and inspiration, in effect, figuratively, he took the baton from him, and he carried it with great dignity and honor.
It's 42 after the hour, which seems only appropriate with Jackie Robinson. So
there you go. And in 2 minutes, it'll be 44.
You cheered me up, Bob.
There you go.
You did it. I'll talk to you next year at this time.
All right, Dan. Be well. Have a good 2021.
Thank you, Bob. Bob Costas. This Saturday, MLB Network will re-air the Sounds of Baseball episodes with Vin Scully, Al Michaels, and Tony Kubek. It starts at 2 Eastern, hosted by Bob and Tom Verducci. Thanks for listening to the Dan Patrick Show podcast. Be sure to catch us live every weekday morning, 9 until noon Eastern, 6 to 9 Pacific on Fox Sports Radio. And you can find us on the iHeartRadio app at FSR or stream us live on the Peacock app.